This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElroy.
Yeah, we've been all over the country as usual. I've been hearing about a strange beast seen for the first time in a long time in the Murray Firth near Inverness, and learning the secret arts of sled dog racing.
I went to the site of what's regarded as being Scotland's oldest railway, so old in fact that it was actually made out of wood. And one of the great iconic images of Scotland is the Hieland Coo, this big ginger hairy critter, etc., with the horns sticking out either side. There's a lady out in Deeside in Aberdeenshire, and she's working away with Highland cows and producing some beautiful beef. But what I really like about it, admire about it, is the way she's packaging up the entire experience.
And there's real bagpipes.
Indeed. Anyway, have you ever looked at a beach and wondered about where all the pebbles and rocks came from?
That's a lifetime's work.
Well, it's not
little,
doing it individually.
The little red one and the little blue one.
Yeah. Last night, funnily enough, I stayed in Stonehaven, just south of here, in a hotel. And they very kindly gave me one of the sea view rooms. So all night, because it's a stone beach in Stonehaven, all night I was hearing this
rumbling
backwards and forwards. It's like being rocked in the cradle. It's lovely. I loved it.
Yeah.
Anyway, are the rocks that you see in the beach local? Where do they come from? How do they get there? Why are they all different types? All of these questions I was interested to find out about, so I took a walk along Portobello Beach just outside Edinburgh with geologist Angus Miller.
I love beaches. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm a geologist and rocks are great, but I do think everyone gets pebbles. Mm-hmm. And when you look around, and yeah, this beach, a bit scrappy. You know, you get bits of brick here.
Smoothed off brick.
Yeah, a bit of concrete. But that's all, you know, it's all part of it, because what you're seeing here is just a long story of interaction of all the different natural processes that are going on in the Firth of Forth, and it changes.
Mm-hmm. Talk me through some of the types of rock that you're seeing here, because obviously you're looking at it with a geologist's eye.
Most of it's local. So I can see bits of sandstone, for example. Very flat pebble like that. Same sort of colour as we see in the Edinburgh buildings. It's sandstone from the Carboniferous period. All this stuff locally is between 360 and 300 million years ago, Carboniferous period. That's just one of the rocks of the local area. So the sandstone's doing pretty well. It survives, it gets knocked around a bit, bits gradually get chipped off it. Whereas there's a lot of the rock locally as mudstone, and it just disintegrates. So you might have some lovely fossils in it, but the sea pounds it and it just disappears. So we're not seeing the whole story, but we are getting this lovely selection with the added attraction that it's not all local, because we've got the larger processes that over time bring stuff from further away.
But how does that happen? You're talking about a lump of rock. How does it travel?
Well, there's a lot of different things going on, but I suppose one of the big things is that this beach is not recent. It's not just formed. There's a lot of stuff on this beach that has been kicking around, maybe not at this exact location, but it'll be kicking around for thousands of years. One of our big stories all over Scotland is the Ice Age and glaciation. And so a lot of this stuff on this beach has come down the Forth. So the ice built up in the Southern Highlands and basically swept past Stirling and swept all the way down the Firth of Forth. No sea at the time. The North Sea was completely empty. So the ice just kept on going out to the east there. And it picked up all the stuff that was in its way. And a lot of these fragments of rock just get pulverised as the ice moves, and they turn into sand and gravel, and then they're going to get washed away when the ice melts. But a lot of these grey rocks here, these speckly grey ones, these are dolerite, and scattered from here all the way up the Firth of Forth, including the crag that Stirling Castle's sitting on and lots of other bits in between is all made of this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's igneous, it's been formed from magma. It's really tough. You can see the crystals in it,
yeah,
fitting together really strongly. And the ice picks that up and drags it along, breaks it up a bit. These lovely round shapes are actually coming from that. But then when the ice is finished with it, it's not going anywhere. Sitting waiting for the next ice sheet to come. The other secret thing about beaches where geologists love them is because we're getting these fresh rocks. There's no bloody lichen or forests or peat bogs, you know. This is stuff. It's getting washed by the sea twice a day, you know. It's getting bashed against each other. So we're seeing the rocks actually as they were meant to be seen.
That's actually a point about being washed by the sea, because every child knows you take a pebble, you stick it in the water, it comes to life.
Yeah. That's absolutely.
It really brings the colours out.
When we're doing stuff with kids, you say, yeah, take it down to the puddle, wet it, because you see the fossils in it, you see the features in it much better. Everyone's had that experience of, on a wet day, moping along a beach and picking up a handful of pebbles and taking them home, and they don't look quite so beautiful when you've got them dry.
That is bone.
It is a real bone.
It's a socket of something.
Yeah,
kind of big catalogue.
I thought it was going to be sandstone, but it's, you know, you're absolutely right. It's bone shaped and bone density.
Yeah, precisely.
And that's, yeah. We've obviously got the shells as well, and that's all contributing, breaking up and contributing to the sand. But once you start looking at it, all the variety of the local area and all the things that have gone on in this really long geological story, contributing a mix of rocks that you get to enjoy.
On a beach, what gets you really excited as a geologist?
I think it is just the variety, and I do get excited. This is my local beach. I live about a mile away, and come here with a dog, and I do appreciate it. I do notice it, and I think once you're switched onto a subject, you do tend to notice when you see it. So I do like looking at this and seeing the variety and thinking about where they've all come from. Mm-hmm. But also when you travel around Scotland, you've got that amazing, you know, go around a corner, and because the geology's changed or the currents have changed, or you know, the situation has changed, you get a completely different beach.
I remember being on the west coast of Lewis and walking along a beach, and it was just covered in little bits of pumice stone, which had probably come from Iceland, you know, floated across the sea. Now, there's a mind-boggling thought.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's, I think there's bits of pumice from the Caribbean have made their way across as well. So you get some dark bits and you get light bits. People sometimes give me bits of pumice from the round about the Firth of Forth here, and I look at it and I say, well, it's probably a breeze block. Because it's quite hard to imagine one of the kind of really explosive volcanoes erupting in the Atlantic and it's, you know, stuff getting all the way around here, but who knows? But I have certainly, you know, bricks and breeze blocks and bits of tile and everything as well. So, part of the mix.
Yeah. Look at that. It's like a little stone with varicose veins.
Yeah, it's got veins in it. It's, I think, probably a local sandstone. It's quite kind of a reddish colour.
So what will cause the veining then?
So it's been buried. It's been sand buried, made into sandstone, and then there's been a bit of movement, a bit of cracking, and hot water circulating through it. So you're just getting these beautiful, very, very fine little mineral veins created.
Hot water?
Yeah, once you get deep down, you get quite a, you know, it's quite easy to get up to temperatures of where the water circulating is actually dissolving some of the minerals from the rock and then re-precipitating it. Yeah, hundreds of degrees centigrade under pressure, so it's not steam, but it's getting warm. And there's another example that's just really the same thing but on a bigger scale, and that's a Highland rock. So it's quartz vein and the grey stuff schist, and that's been brought by the ice almost certainly. You see a lot of that here because it's pretty tough. You know, once it's in on the beach, it's not much happening to it. 20,000 years ago, the peak of the ice, you know, it's been dragged into this area, and then the ice has melted and left it behind.
Geologist Angus Miller there, and Angus runs guided walks, so if you are interested in finding out more about geology, there is an address to his website from ours.
Have you still got your favourite pebble collection from around Scotland and the world?
Listen, I know I am not alone in this foible. Yeah, I've got rocks from around the world, little bits. I mean, nothing huge at all. And it means nothing to anybody other than me, but it reminds me of where I've been, that's all.
I was laughing at you for being a sad person with all that, and I was looking out my conservatory window the other day, and I thought, That wall you built,
yes,
you built it from rocks taken from all over Scotland,
right,
every different kind of geological class,
mm-hmm,
and all got a wee memory as well.
Yeah.
It's like having a collection of bricks.
Ah, yes, yes. You see, there were bricks when I was down. You'll hear it later with the Kakenzie piece with the wagonway, you know, the wooden railway. There were lots of interesting bricks on the shoreline there too. And as I was traipsing over these bricks, I thought, you wouldn't like these. Bricks through the ages.
Did you bring any back?
No. We've just come out of what's been dubbed veganary. You know, the idea was to sort of drop meat for January and try a vegan lifestyle. Absolutely fine, no problem at all. It's a choice that a lot of people want to make. But I went to visit recently a farm near Bankery where red meat, beef, is very much on the agenda from source to plate. Grace Noble is the owner of the first Aberdeenshire Highland cow beef business.
I've got 130, around that number in the herd. Numbers fluctuate because I produce a premium beef product. So I'm slaughtering every week my Highland cattle. And
is that difficult?
In what way?
Emotionally.
Yeah. Emotionally. Well, I love the breed. You know, they are beautiful. But they also produce, you know, premium quality beef. That's what they're there for. And that does surprise people. A lot of visitors or people at agricultural shows that exhibit cattle at, they ask, what do you do with your Highlanders, you know? And they're astonished to hear that, you know, you can eat them, you know? So I says, yes, not only do they look good, but they taste great as well, you know?
This is a magnificent specimen.
He's a young bull here. He's been growing on. He's kind of an unusual one. He is white. He does need a wee wash, but it's that time of year. Yeah, he is white, yes.
Honest, yeah.
It's with all this snowy and wet weather we've had lately.
Got a good spread of horn,
uh-huh,
and you've got the copper ringing in his nose,
yes,
etc. And he's just, he is a Highland bull from Central Casting, basically.
Uh-huh, yes, yeah. You know, you just know straight away. I mean, a lot of people, when they see the horns, they, you know, some folk will say, oh, they think they're all male, but, you know, they all have horns, Highland cattle. They're just such a beautiful, iconic beast, you know.
I remember reading somewhere, you know, you've got black ones behind you here,
yeah,
that initially some of the breeders wouldn't touch the red ones at all. They saw them as being inferior.
Yes, yeah. But, you know, going back, you know, a lot of them were wee black, short, wiry, you know, harder Highlanders, you know, in the Highlands and Islands, you know, where they really were farmed in years gone by, but they have evolved in size over the years. Uh-huh. Likes of myself, you know, I particularly look for large framed Highlanders because ultimately I'm looking for a good beef carcass, you know, that's going to yield plenty beef, plenty flesh on it. As you say, you get lots of different colours, black, red, ginger, you know, white, dun, brindle. And a lot of it for breeders, you know, it's their own personal preference, you know, what they like.
What do they actually feed on?
They really feed on everything outdoors, the natural environment, you know. I farm a lot up in the Cairnamount, part of Fasken Glendie Estate. So it's really, excuse me,
yes.
It's really rough hillside, heather, wild grasses, rough terrain. And, you know, they can convert that, you know. They don't get fed a daily ration of concentrates or things like that. They just rough it up the hills.
Native breeds are excellent for that. I mean, not only can they cope with, I mean, really serious wintry, mm-hmm, ghastly conditions.
Yes, yeah.
You know, but, you know, they can take rough grazing and convert it into something.
Yeah,
really,
yeah.
Special.
Well, I've regenerated some rough waste ground areas that nobody else would have touched, you know, and now the grass is really good on it, you know, because they have, you know, churned up the ground and got rid of the whins and the gorse bushes and things like that, and now encourage the good grasses. The vetting down the rank and promotes the regeneration, really, of the good grass. So, and I think that's what really adds to the flavour of the beef, because it's really, you know, they're eating all the good,
oh, come
the best
on,
of nature.
Don't tell me you can actually taste it.
Yes, you can. Yeah, and you'll get a little beef tasting at the end. So, you know, the proof is in the eating, as they say, you know.
How do you go about marketing this stuff?
Well, I started farming 6 years ago, built up my herd gradually, and obviously, you know, I had to make them pay for themselves and produce my beef, you know, find my own niche market, because it is a native breed, you know, it's not really farmed that commercially as a pure beef breed, then built the butchery so that I could do everything myself, bar, of course, killing the slaughter of the animal. It's got to be done on an approved licensed premises. Mm-hmm. So that's done in Inverurie. We take the beasts over weekly and get the carcasses back so that I can age them, in the traditional way in a chiller, again, which I've built and expanded now so I can upscale my production.
How long do you hang them for?
For 28 days, which really is what my chefs ask for, you know.
What does that do? I mean, if you hang a slab of beef...
Hanging it there, it just allows the muscles to relax and the meat to tenderise and the flavours to develop. So it does, it adds to the quality of it. And as I say, you know, you've taken all that care to rear your animal, you know, why spoil it in that process, you know? Don't rush it, yeah.
Aside from being, obviously, probably, I reckon, the most aesthetically pleasing of all the cattle breeds,
they're actually quite friendly wee critters too, aren't they?
Yes, well, I really do have very petted ones in the herd. You know, I show them as I mentioned to you, agricultural shows, and you spend a lot of time with them, you know, halter training them and getting them used to being handled. They certainly are used to all the visitors coming to the farm and getting their photos. And Jenny, my butcher, she welcomes like her tour visitors to the farm by playing the bagpipes. So they get acquainted with all that, you know.
And no cliche untouched.
Yeah, no cliche. Well,
we don't care.
It's really authentic, you know, and it's giving, you know, particularly our international visitors, that warm Scottish genuine welcome, you know.
And, well, the thing is, it's what they expect.
Yeah, it's what they expect and it's what they enjoy, you know. So in here is a pop-up shop that's on at the weekends. So people can come to the farm between 9 and 5, Saturday and Sunday, can select what beef cuts, it's all individually priced, put their money in an envelope in the box. And that's it, because I'm not here all the time. I'm often out on the farm working.
So it's an honesty box for really quite big chunks of meat.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, it works beautifully. You know, it's people that are coming because they want to buy quality beef, you know, they come to the farm, that's their intention, you know. And a lot of them like to have a wee look at the cattle while they're here and just know where, they're getting their beef, their provenance of their food. You know, maybe people are eating less red meat in their diet now, you know, so when they do, they want something special, they're prepared to pay that little bit more. You know, it's all about supplying my hotels and restaurants, you know, it's high-end steakhouses that want to source the best. They want to have it written on their menu, you know, like Aberdeenshire Highland Beef, farmed by Grace, a farmer in Bankery. So it's telling the story to their customers that are prepared to pay. That seems to be what people love, you know, and you've got to love it. It's got to be your passion. And my career was environmental health. I worked for a good 18 years with local authority and Highland Council and Aberdeen City latterly and enjoyed my job. But really, you know, the outdoors was where I wanted to be. And having grown up on the West Coast on a little island, Isle of Rassie, next to Isle of Skye, I was outside all the time and just loved it, you know.
Would you like a wee taster?
Let's have a wee taster.
Yeah, a wee taster.
Okay. So what we've got here in the slow cooker is rump steak diced. I've just put it in with a little bit of salt and a carrot and an onion and just left it to cook away itself. You know, I've not added any flavourings or anything, and you can just, so that you can taste the flavour for yourself.
Okay, give it a go. Mm-hmm. Here it goes. That's lovely. Yeah. That's really nice.
Good for steak pies and things like that.
How long's that been on for?
I put that on at 9 o'clock. So, yeah. We're in mid-afternoon now. So,
this is going to be really rubbish radio because I'm not going to ask any questions. So this is finished. Seriously, I cannot believe it. If that is just the steak, an onion, salt, carrot, that's extraordinary.
Yeah. No, the flavor.
There's no stock in that at all?
It none at all. Not at all. Not at all. But
I am thoroughly impressed.
So, thank you. And the mince, it's a really lean animal as well. You know, customers will say, oh, wow, when you brown off your mince, there's no fat, you know. And it is. It's a leaner beef. It's lower in cholesterol. You've got really thick coats, so they don't lay down the same amount of layers of fat. I actually bring them in when they're reaching maturity into the shed for the final 6 weeks of their life. And they get fed a diet of draft, which is a byproduct from Deeside Brewery. They just cart it in to me. And potatoes.
Does that change the taste of the beef?
It doesn't. They're only getting it in their final 6 weeks of their life. And it's really just putting that finishing fat layer on them, finishing their carcasses off to a primer standard, you know, and they just sleep, eat, relax, and they've been outside all their life, not seeing much of interaction with humans, and then they come down into the shed and, you know, they chill out, relax, they get a lovely bed of straw and they see you every day and they just really chill, and it just finishes them to that prime standard.
Grace Noble there with her heeling coos. And as I say, just the entire package, the fact that, you know, a butcher is a woman who happens to play the bagpipes, and when people turn up to see around the farm, she's standing there playing the pipes in a butcher's apron. It's just a Scottish package. Yeah, shows imagination.
And I'm not being critical in any way, shape or form of producers of Highland beef, which I'll personally vouch for is fantastic. Probably the best beef in the world. But her approach to marketing, her website, the pop-up shop is just brilliant. It is really high-class stuff.
I think the other thing that impressed me, this didn't appear on the piece there, but, you know, she was reeling off all the various organisations and trade bodies and things that she's worked with. Again, it's a much more collaborative team approach to marketing a product, so it's clever. Do you ever give much thought to Watervliet?
Never far from my thoughts.
Yeah, so seldom a morning goes by without you wake up thinking, how's Ratty doing?
Well, it's that lovely image, that opening piece to Wind in the Willows, where the bubbles are going along the water. Mm-hmm. And at the bottom of those bubbles is a water vault.
Well, down near Aberfoyle in the Trossachs area, Queen Elizabeth Forest Park, they were out of water vaults because American mink had basically just gone through the entire population and done them in. Over the past 10 years, Forest Enterprise have been running a water vault project in an area which, up until then, as I say, we didn't have any. Katie Anderson is Habitats Manager for Forest Enterprise at Aberfoyle.
The project began back in 2006 when we aimed to restore water voles to the Trossachs. Water voles had been extinct here for many years and we'd been doing a lot of habitat restoration work. We had created lots of lovely wetlands by digging ponds and blocking drainage ditches. And we had an opportunity to get some water voles from a development site in Glasgow.
I was going to ask you about that, because it's a bit like Mrs. Beaton, you know, jugged here, first catch your hair. Where do you find water voles, spare water voles?
Yeah, so we were approached by an ecologist who had been working at a development site in Glasgow where they were building some houses, and water voles had to be removed from the site as part of the mitigation for the development. And they had heard that we had lots of lovely water vole habitat but didn't have any water voles. So they approached us to see whether we would have sites suitable for their voles that needed a home. And when they came and looked at our sites, they realised we had such an extensive area of good wetland habitat available that we decided to form a landscape scale reintroduction project, which involved breeding up the voles that were collected in Glasgow and creating a much larger population that could be released into the landscape.
So the first question that would have crossed my mind is, or presumably it crossed yours too, why did they become extinct here in the first place? What was wiping them out here?
Okay, so it was a combination of factors. There'd been a lot of habitat degradation over many years. Wetlands had been drained. On forestry ground, we weren't very sensitive to wetland habitats in the past either. Basically, shading out all the water voles' habitat, they rely on having lots of vegetation on the edge of the waterway. That's where they live. So by planting trees right up to the water's edge, you're destroying that habitat. But really, the nail in the coffin for water voles across much of the UK has been the introduced American mink. Huge areas of habitat have been ruined, but then where you have got pockets of good habitat left and water voles remaining, American mink that have been released from fur farms were then able to come through and wipe out those pockets of water voles that were left and basically just create massive extinction on a wide scale across lots of the UK.
Trying to imagine what the experience must have been like for your average Ouija water vole to be picked up, transplanted here to the Trossachs. I mean, was it a captive breeding program? How difficult is it to breed water voles?
Well, there's a man based down in Devon who has a lot of experience of breeding water voles.
So they had to go to Devon first?
Exactly, yes.
Really?
So there's a guy called Derek Gow who's been involved with all of the water vole reintroduction projects all over the UK. He's an extremely experienced water vole breeder. He was involved with collecting the water voles from Glasgow. As you say, they were then taken down to Devon where they were put into breeding pens. So they were paired up and left there for the breeding season with water and fed every day. And by the end of the breeding season, you've got lots more water voles to then go on and put out into your reintroduction site.
See, I can remember the days of Tales from the Riverbank, Hammy the Hamster with a little biplane and things like that. Ratty, again, I've only seen one water vole live once in my life, and I'm well struck in years. They're not terribly easy to see. Describe it to me.
Some people think they're quite rat-like in appearance, hence the name Ratty. Mm-hmm. But they're actually... they're very different to a rat. They have a much rounder, cuter face with much kind of more chestnutty fur, and the tail is completely furred rather than scaly. And when they're swimming in the water, they're just much more buoyant.
It's kind of a chunky monkey too. I mean, you see it sort of going through... It's quite businesslike going through the water.
Yes, they are. They're creatures of habit. When they're out there, they're following their runways. And the one thing you do notice when you're in water vole habitat is you hear the plops of them escaping into the water when they hear you coming. That's their escape mechanism, is just to dive into the water with a very loud splash, creating this plop sound to warn all the other water voles that there's danger about.
What impact does it have on a sort of ecological pyramid when you reintroduce a species into a gap like that? Do you see a difference in the landscape?
Yes, water voles, as you say, are at the bottom of the food chain, so you wouldn't want to be one. They're on everybody's menu. All the predators in the forest will have benefited from having this extra food source available. We have a lot of owl boxes in the forest, another conservation project, and we noticed an increase in barn owls in areas where we'd reintroduced water voles pretty much straight away after the reintroduction. So they were obviously taking advantage of this new food source that was available. We've also had footage of water voles turning up in eagle eyries away up in the hills as well.
How does that make you feel? Because you're busy trying to get them back into the landscape and everything else has taken them out.
Well, that's what they're for. You know, they're an important part of the food chain. They're an important food source for our native predators. So I'm more than happy for that to happen. You know, that's brilliant. As long as it's not mink coming in and eating our water voles and it's native carnivores and native predators that are taking them, then that's brilliant.
Katie Anderson of Forest Enterprise. It's a real success story. And what I really admire about that is they know full well that they're putting a lot of time and effort into replacing a species which is essentially a food source for just about everything else.
Yeah, it's great, but it spreads the load and it becomes in harmony with the environment, yeah, and it sustains a population of birds of prey. It's a great thing.
Yeah. Quite a few years ago, I was across in Norway doing some recording and went out on a sled dogging experience with a guy called Odd Kveen. He was a farmer who diversified in this. I thoroughly enjoyed it, but it did come as something of a shock to discover that you actually got your own sled. For some reason, I thought I would be sitting there swathed in furs with a furry cap on and somebody else would drive the flipping thing, but no, that didn't happen at all.
Well, you've got a very different experience here in the Cairngorms. Alan Stewart for the Cairngorms Sled Dog Centre. I think you'd be right with Alan.
Yes, several times. Several times. Very interesting character.
Yeah, he used to do safaris. That was basically him on the back taking passengers. But he's changed the business and now gives demonstrations in the techniques of sled dog racing. I was a bit intrigued, and Alan was happy to explain it.
Sitting in the middle of the dog yard and amongst my canine mates, and we're looking at my apprentice lead dog called Willow and little Ruby, her mate.
And little Ruby's got that lovely piercing ice blue eyes.
Yes, some dogs have one blue eye, other eye brown. It's just one of these gene things that are kicked up over the genes.
Let me kick off with a stupid question. Why use dogs rather than reindeer or something like that?
My sport comes from the Klondike, the Gold Rush days, where business people started off with horses back in the mid-1800s, and the horses died very quickly, and then they moved into sled dogs. And around about the mid-1800s, real dog lines started appearing, and these gene lines have started all the way through the sport up to now. I was very fortunate. My son's a professional sled dog racer, and we've got great contacts from a very young age. And when I wanted to start the sled dog centre, I needed a dog that's bomb-proof, that's really proven, and that's an Alaskan Husky. So I'm very lucky. I got off my tail, went to Montana, and I got the dogs. I got the bloodline from Doug Swinley, who's won the 1,200-mile sled dog race.
Presumably that's not a cheap thing to do.
No. This is not a hobby or a game. It's a way of life. And this is the way that I love working. Lucky that the wife is interested in it. But it's quite a selfish sport when you start. Nobody comes into it unless you go forward.
So this is a big question, but how would you go about training your first dog and then training all six or all eight?
Well, when I started the sport, I asked a huge amount of questions. I only got the real answers when I started living and working with professional sled dog racers like in the States and Minnesota, and they opened the door up. The secret with these dogs, especially with the Alaskan Husky or the Eurohound, we call them, you don't have to train them to pull. The gene does it in 20 seconds.
Presumably there's more to than clipping it on the back of a sled dog.
Yeah, you have to very much so start training them to run with each other, to work with each other. I work with a blue team, a red team, and eventually a black team appears from those two teams. But it's like everything else in this world. If you're doing it 24-7, I put 7 months of the year simply to run my dogs, and it all starts coming together.
But take me back to that very initial stage. How do you convince a dog to run as part of a team rather than just all taking off in different directions?
Well, the gene is there already. You've already established the gene that the dog wants to run. It's like getting a German short-haired pointer. It points. Nobody trains it to point. But with a sled dog, you have to introduce them to a team. I introduce them with an older dog. The older dog then trains the young dog. And then we get the understanding that the dog is happy running beside the other dog, and then we start. The hard part is training the dog to run beside everybody. All my dogs have to run up front, and they have to be moved around the team. That's the hard part. But it's just constant repeat, repeat, repeat all the time.
How do you get them to run at the same speed, though?
You're holding them back with the quad or the snowmobile. I don't know anybody in the snows that runs on sleds. My son trains on huge snowmobiles in Canada, and they just pace the dogs at 8 miles per hour. When you're racing at real races, your GPSs are showing you exactly how what you've been doing in the training. The racing is very much a small part of the bigger picture.
Do you have to slow them down, or do they slow down naturally on a hill and or rein them in on a slope?
Yeah, that's a good question. My dogs think it's easy going up mountains. They think it's hard going down the mountains. The trick when you start training them with motorised vehicles is to train them not to listen to the engine, because they think it's me that's talking to the engine. I don't physically speak to my dogs either, as in I don't have a verbal conversation with my dogs. My dogs are hooked up to their harnesses, then they're on cables, and I speak to them through the cable.
Just a wee twitch.
Just holding them back. I can hit the brake once to go left, hit the brake twice to go right, or I can get off and just scoot or push the sled, just that little bit on the, so they feel it on their shoulders to go forward.
But if you're training them to pull snowmobiles and big heavy things, what happens when you put them on a super light slide? I mean, it must be happy days the way we are shooting.
No, the dogs are pulling just a wee bit above the weight of what they would be doing. The secret with the sleds, they don't pull anything. It's the weight of a deck chair. A 12 dog to an 18 dog team will be pulling the weight of a deck chair. It's like jumping on a set of skis fully waxed. If you know what you're doing with wax, the dog's just... It's just like Grand Prix racing, motorbikes, cars, anything. You pace yourself at a certain speed. You can go quicker, but the quicker you go, the more tired the dogs will get.
There's a fair bit of snow at the moment, but you're saying there's not enough to actually for a sled. But is there still an interest in what you're doing in terms of how you're training the dogs or taking them out on the wheeled sled?
Yes, a lot of interest. We get a lot of interested, especially gun dog, sheet dog people. They come and see, they're interested. We've had the head of London, Manchester police. They've come here and seen what we do with dogs. anybody who works with dogs 24/7 are blown away when they come out with us, because when they train with themselves, and boy, these guys and girls train with dogs, they only train one dog or maybe two. But the thing is with these guys, they're training their dogs off the line. They haven't got any power. All these dogs are undomesticated. They don't sit down, go for walks. We don't take them down the top. Well, they're great mates of mine, but I would never put a sled dog near tarmac. I would never put them on a lead to domineer them by the neck. You know, it's just... But sadly, a lot of places and countries, they can't find the facilities, they can't get the sponsorship, and they have to govern down to 3 miles of a sled dog race.
So is it dying then?
Oh, finished. Uh-huh. Oh, it's finished totally in the UK, I believe.
But there's still Canada and...
Canada's good. I heard the big race. I'm speaking to two of my mates that are racing this weekend in the Yukon Quest, and they say it's hardly any snow there. But you've got to put 1,200 miles in, and there's a team of about 14 pisting it before the dogs are going. My son's done the 1,200 miles, but again, I don't know if I would like to go to that level that he's done, because he's done it since he's 6, and now he's about 34, 35. But again, it's all just a way of life, you know, and I won't be breeding any more dogs. If I breed any more dogs, about 5 years ago, they will outlive me, and dogs are for 16, 17 years. But the dog line will be going back to John. That's what I'm looking at.
Alan Stewart from Cairngorm Dog Sled Centre.
Got to be... admire the dedication and the work that's involved in that.
You walk down the dog lanes there, you know, in his kennels. I'm sure it's still the same, but, you know, the dogs actually come up on these platforms, like small tables, so they are eye to eye with you, and just got these piercing, pale blue eyes. You look at it and you think, are you sure that's a dog? Really?
It's very close to a wolf. But the point he was making is they're not pets.
No.
And they're possibly not even working dogs. These are... edging on wild dogs that are just prepared to tolerate being put in a harness.
Yeah, as you say, it's a lifestyle more than anything else. It's a choice. You've got to be really dedicated to it.
That's why we never do it.
Indeed. The Battle of Preston Pans, dating back to 1745, was really the first significant battle of the Jacobite uprising. I found myself on the spot where the battle took place recently, not to find out about the battle, because some 20-odd years earlier, it was also the location for what's known as a wagonway, a very early railway. Alan Braby and Ed Bethunes are members of the 1722 Wagonway Heritage Group.
We're standing at the midpoint of the first railway in Scotland, built in 1722 to carry coal from the pits at Trinent down to the harbour at Port Seton. And the point where we're standing is... now the most unspoiled section of the original route, and it also happens to be where the Battle of Preston Pans took place.
When we talk about a railway, describe it to me.
Initially, it would have just been a wooden railway, so it would have been wooden sleepers with wooden rails on it, and the wagons themselves would have been entirely wooden construction as well, which would have just run down under gravity from the pits at Trinent down to the harbours, just purely under gravity.
We've walked up from Kakenzie village itself, and it's not a huge incline, but I wouldn't want to push a wagon back up it.
No, so the way they solved that in the early days was they hauled the empties back up with a couple of horses attached. They'd take 4 or 5 wagons at a time. And the empty wagons, we've built a replica one. One or two people can push it along quite easily when it's empty. So, you know, it's easy to see how a couple of horses could take a train back up. So it was the simplest and most effective way of doing it.
Yeah. Let's take a wander back down again, back downhill. When you started this project, presumably you were thinking in terms of the railway. And I suppose because you're looking at the railway, this leads you on to looking to other aspects of the industrial heritage of this area.
Absolutely. The reason the railway existed was to bring coal down for the salt pans, which were pre-existing from the early 1600s. And inevitably, we started looking at the salt industry. And we've even built a replica salt pan, and we make salt on a regular basis in the traditional way.
Explain that to me. Just describe how that actually works, because obviously in other countries you can build salt pans and let the sun do it.
Yes.
You'd wait a long time in Kakenzie for that to happen.
It would never happen. Traditionally in Scotland, all around the coasts where there are coal outcrops, so around the Forth, around the Tay and areas like that, there are traditionally salt pans as well. What they would have done, they would have had a large iron pan which they would have filled with seawater.
How large?
Well, the ones we've got here in the latter stages are 18 foot by 9 feet.
Wow!
By about a foot and a half, 2 feet deep.
Okay.
So, I mean, it holds a lot of seawater. So that was decanted out collecting ponds on the foreshore, bucketed out or pumped out into the pans. The coal that came down would have been used to feed the furnace under one end, and all the hot gases and the heat basically evaporated the salt water out of the pans. And then, you know, they evaporated it, refilled it, evaporated it, refilled it. And at the end of the period, it crystallises as a salt. Uh-huh. And it's just a case of collecting it and drying it.
From an archaeological standpoint, how much evidence of what existed here have you been able to find?
We've got the walls of one of the pan houses that we've excavated. Mm-hmm. And we've got all the industrial waste that's left over from all the burning processes in the furnace. We've got that. We've got hints of the metalwork that went with the pan, although when the salt pan building went out of use, all the metalwork would have been scrapped and recycled.
So another little point of interest on the where we're standing now, a little bit further down the hill, if we backtrack to 1745, on the 21st of September, at dawn, we'd be looking at the backs of the government forces as they lined up to face the Jacobites.
So the Hanoverians would be right in front of us and the Jacobites would be across somewhere in that copse of trees.
We'd be looking at redcoat tails here and beyond that, a misty scene at dawn with the Highland charge coming out of it.
This is like a very low-tech equivalent to the opening sequence in Thunderbirds. This is wonderful. Now, what we've got here, basically, is a wooden wagon with wooden wheels. How did you come by this?
We made it from scratch. Essentially, we had a number of old plans, diagrams, and a couple of fantastic photographs which were found under the floors of Kakenzie House in the 70s, depicting the harbour and the wagons that were used on the wagonway. So putting all the various elements of the jigsaw puzzle together, we were able to produce... Alan made a fantastic design for our wagon for us, as near as we could to one of the early wagons. And we got a load of old timber and built it from scratch to use as a display piece and also as a prop in the battle reenactment for the Preston Pans battle, which took place last September.
I'll be honest, it looks to me as if you got the timber off pallets.
Believe it or not, it was driftwood. All the timber came off a Russian cargo ship that lost its deck cargo down the Cleveland coast about this time last year, and it all washed ashore in the Firth of Forth, and we managed to get enough timber to build James here. Yeah.
So James being the...
James Patterson.
Named after?
James Patterson was a young lad whose dad was the smith here, and he was the first young lad to be killed on a railway in Scotland.
28th of August 1762. There's no details about how he got in front of the wagon, but he was recorded as being bruised by the wagon and passed away and buried in Trenent Kirkyard the next day.
And from here, this kind of wagon would go all the way down to the harbour. So let's have a shifty down there and just see what the situation is. Last time I came past here, actually, was with Ewan, and we were cycling the John Muir Way along to Dunbar, and we found ourselves actually coming along here. This was the terminus of what we've established as Scotland's oldest railways, one of the oldest railways in the world. Talk me through the geography of this place.
Essentially, we're standing on the very edge of this shoddy tarmac road, and we've come to an area that we dug in September, and where Alan's standing there is where one of the little turntables that they used for spinning the wagons 90 degrees onto a tipping mechanism was. So, turntable, we discovered a beautiful stone cavity with a central pivot, then a space for the tipping mechanism designed by Robert Stevenson, and then beyond...
And it tipped the whole wagon? It's not as if the end of the wagon came off.
No, it tipped the whole wagon, and then all you need to do is release the catch, and then the weight of the coal would take it out. Right. So you're tipping the wagon 45 degrees to give it enough oomph to get down onto the chute, which took it into the hold of the ship. This is really the beginnings of the heavy industry for export of things like coal from harbours like this.
You're obviously very passionate about this, and it may be more of a professional thing with you, Alan, I don't know, but do local people care about this? I mean, the fact that this is the site one of the earliest railways in the world?
Yes, they do. Basically, as you can see, bits of the harbour have been sadly neglected. In our excavations over the last couple of years, we've stripped back basically the topsoil and the windblown stuff and the rubbish back to, as you can see, what is Robert Stevenson's original harbour surface. And it's amazing how it's left. And this is how it was in the 40s. And then it gradually got run down and then it just got covered over. So we're kind of re-uncovering it. And I think the locals are very interested in what they're doing because it's how they remembered it. as kids who were playing around here, they always knew the railway came down here. They knew there was a salt works because some of the buildings were still standing in the mid-40s. So I think they're very proud of us uncovering part of their heritage again.
Alan Braby and Ed Bethune of the 1722 Wagonway Heritage Group. If you go on to our Facebook page, Out of Doors, you'll see a picture of the two lads standing in front of the wagonway, that the wagon that they recreated. Now, what I like about that is you would load this up with coal, start it off at the top of the hill, and there was a guy sitting there on a brake, basically just a wooden brake, trying to slow this thing heading down towards the harbour.
It could go very wrong.
Yeah. Casey Jones or Stephen and a Roland.
But, you know, you've got the wagon. It all requires a few sleepers.
Yes.
And you could reinstate the whole thing. How fantastic would that be?
It requires a few sleepers. Let's put a fourth crossing across the fourth. All it's going to take is a few ladders. It'll be fine.
Yeah, but if you bypass the engineers and get the Rotary Club to do it...
There you have a point. There you have a point. That refers back to a couple of weeks ago we were talking about the Ayrshire Coastal Path, where the local Rotary Club put up something like 40 miles of paths in a year and a half. I mean, quite extraordinary. But not so much the physical effort they put into it, but the fact that they could network that efficiently and get everybody to tick off and say, yep, absolutely, you can stick your path through here and what have you. They got it organised and built in 18 months. Quite extraordinary. Over the next few weeks, bird watchers will be scanning the northeast skies for the arrival of one of the world's most fascinating birds. Beautiful thing. And the news that Scotland now has an absolutely tiny breeding population of cranes is really enthralling ornithologists like Howell Maggs, Senior Conservation Officer for RSPB East Scotland.
Cranes are a large bird. They've got a long neck. They stand about 1.2 metres tall. They're not particularly heavy for the size, the height. They're about 5 kilograms, but they've got a wingspan of about 2 metres.
So it's a big beast.
Yeah, quite a big beast indeed, yeah.
It's kind of like a heron to a certain extent.
They are like herons, and a lot of people think they're related to herons, but actually more related to rails and crakes, so species such as moorhens and coots.
And there are suggestions, you know, nobody knows the answer to this, that they're possibly the oldest bird in the world.
Yeah, that's not something...
You're going to disagree with me. Yeah. We can't prove either way.
They could well be. I mean, they've been referred to a lot in historical literature, but in terms of whether it's the first bird ever, who knows?
But they're very popular in Japanese Oriental mythology.
Yeah, and they've got a lot of character cranes. I mean, more recently, during the period of recolonisation and people and cranes coming more in contact, places like Sweden make a lot out of cranes, particularly, you know, their stopover points where they congregate in huge numbers and the courtship displays, the dancing. It's quite a spectacle to see.
Yeah, we'll come on to the dancing in a second, but they used to be here, didn't they?
Yeah, so 400 years ago, it's probably inconceivable to think that we didn't have cranes here, although actually finding confirmed evidence has been really difficult. But thinking about reference in historical literature and ancestors' artifacts and things, you know, they were bound to have been here around that time.
But they're also good to eat, which might have helped the extinction.
Yeah, well, that is one of the things that probably added to their downfall. They were often a feature of medieval banquets, along with species that people would recognise, like swans and geese and things.
So when did they arrive in Scotland? When did you first see it? Because it was great excitement, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's with their European population expanding so much, it was kind of inevitable that they would hit Scotland at some stage. But we first got confirmation of breeding back in 2012, but they'd been appearing in the northeast many years before that, but often in areas we would associate with migrant birds.
So they're just passing through?
Yeah, probably. And because we've got that kind of passage of birds and an expanding population from continental Europe, you know, the fact that they're here and certain birds will be looking for new sites to settle on, immigration has probably been part of
So have we got suitable habitat for them to breed?
Yeah, we have got pockets of suitable habitat. So the cranes in northeast Scotland tend to use similar habitats to the habitats cranes use in places like Denmark and Sweden, whereby they're using peatlands, essentially. Peatlands that are surrounded by farmland that have, you know, feeding opportunities such as cropland. And what cranes really need are large, undisturbed, secluded kind of nest sites that have wetlands on them. And we have got a few of those, although it's really important that we safeguard those sites and restore the ones that are degrading to welcome more cranes into the future.
And the good news is there is a breeding pair.
Yeah, well, there's at least one. And in the last few years, there's been two. They've not bred every year, but we've certainly got one established pair. It's been the same pair that we recognise now. The male and the females have been the same birds since 2012. And yeah, more recently, there's a newly formed pair that have bred successfully last year.
So they're pretty distinctive in terms of if they are breeding, it's quite easy to spot it.
Well, actually, you'd think that for a bird that's over a metre high, but they're incredibly difficult to find, incredibly secretive. They're very prone to disturbance. So when they're actually settled and incubating eggs, they tend to become very difficult to find. You can spend hours looking for these birds and not see them.
But they do camouflage themselves.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So they actually paint themselves. So when they're settled on a nest site and they've laid eggs, because they're nesting on the ground, usually in a wet feature, they camouflage themselves with mud on their back, and they darken the back because they're a kind of pale grey bird before they start painting themselves. So, yeah, they are pretty camouflaged when they're settled.
So if they're painting themselves, there's a reasonable chance of maybe coming into breeding.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the signs we look for to establish whether there's been a nesting attempt, if they've got a dark back.
What about the mating ritual? Because that is spectacular.
Yeah, that's one of the sort of key features to draw in people to enjoying cranes. It's quite a dramatic, elaborate dancing routine that they do. So both the male and the female will do lots of head bobbing and jumping up, flapping of wings, and they've got a very elaborate kind of tail that's referred to as a bustle that changes shape in different postures. So it's a fantastic display, and they bugle. They've got this amazing call that echoes and can be heard for kilometres away. And that draws in other cranes, so they can be very sociable. They don't actually just dance to set up breeding territories. They also dance on migration as well.
And they will chuck things at each other as well.
Yeah, they'll pick up bits of vegetation and throw it around. It's all part of the ritual, really. Yeah, it's
you're going to disagree with me here, but I've read somewhere in the mists of time that it was a crane dance that inspired the Greek plate dance, chucking things at each other, jumping in the air.
Well, it sounds absolutely plausible, but it's not something that I have personally heard about.
And it's also really big in the world of origami.
Is it really?
It's said, and it's not been a wasted trip for you, it's said that if you make 1,000 paper cranes, you're guaranteed good luck forevermore.
Well, that's something we should adopt in Scotland, I think.
Owl Mags, RSPB Senior Conservation Officer for North East Scotland. That actually rings a bell. There's a cottage in Rackwick.
Are you implying that I might be right?
There is a slim outside chance on this particular occasion. Statistically, it was bound to happen eventually. But there's a cottage in Rackwick on the island of Hoy, up in Orkney. And I went in there, and hanging from the roof were hundreds of these wee paper cranes. That probably explains why then. Anyway, just we heard cranes right at the beginning of that piece. They seem to have a whole range of sounds. Here's some more of them. I would quite like a crane nesting in my house.
It kind of blocks a chimney, though.
Chimneys don't work in my house anyway.
You could put an artificial crane nest up. That'd be great. Uh-huh. And if you've got cranes where you're listening anywhere in the world, then you've got folklore stories or stories about origami cranes, especially in Japan,
We'd love to hear from it. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Need to figure out how to make an origami crane. Museums are always on the lookout for ways to bring history to life. And there's the Gordon Highlanders Museum here in Aberdeen. They're opening up a new attraction. I went along to have a shifty at it because the whole idea of this actually intrigued me and met up with Lewis Gibbon and Brian Snelling.
So this is our World War I replica trench. It's called Moffat Trench after Dr. Margaret Moffat. She volunteered at the museum for many, many years, and she was also a big funder for the trench. It's actually named after her father, Lieutenant Colonel Francis Moffat. He was in the 10th Battalion, the Gordon Highlanders, in World War I, and probably would have seen the inside of a trench at that time.
First thing that crosses my mind is you've swicked. It's not a trench. You've actually built this trench above the ground, which is quite clever, really.
Well, interesting you should say that. Whilst the convention that people are aware of is that trenches are dug into the ground, quite often there were times, certainly in the First World War, when trenches couldn't be dug down due to the materials in the ground or the location. And actually, there were times when trenches were built up, similar to ours. High Wood would have been one particular occasion.
You actually show people around this, so you're the education officer. Again, first thing that crossed my mind as somebody at 6'1" is I might actually just need to duck down a wee bit here.
Yeah, so it's quite real to the size it would have been in the trenches with the height and everything. And for a tall person like myself and yourself, it just shows you that you'd have to stay low. Uh-huh. And that's why in the trenches, just like we've got around the corners, many signs saying keep your head down, mm-hmm. You know, watch your head from flying artillery and shells and so on.
Snipers and things like that.
Exactly, yeah. So we've got a few different materials that were all used in the trenches to show the different variations. So we've got the corrugated iron, and we've got a few different patterns of it as you move round, mm-hmm. And then the wooden plank, and then it was built with the sandbags along the top that could be moved and angled in different ways. So this is our first dugout, uh-huh. Which is our officer's dugout. So it's all set out. He's got his bed. We've got some uniform and equipment hanging on the walls. Then we've got his maps and plans, and also his local newspapers from back home to see what's happening home, and then his food rations. So it's somewhere an officer could come in and keep cosy instead of being out in the front line like the soldiers, the privates.
When you're talking about uniform, I would describe that as an apron, because I mean, the Gordon Highlanders actually fought in kilts. They lived and fought in kilts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so they went through the whole of the First World War in kilts, with kilt aprons, which were a way of camouflaging the tartan of the kilt, because we had quite a bright yellow stripe that ran through it. So the kilt apron was it came up in around about the Boer War, and then it was used by the Gordons through the First World War.
Surely it must have crossed somebody's mind to say, tell you what, let's not wear kilts.
Well, it wasn't until after the First World War, and they weren't very happy about it when they were told not to wear kilts anymore, even though they did complain about wearing kilts. So, you know, you can't
just
complain
anyway. Yeah,
you can't win.
What does this say?
Doon with the Kaiser.
And we've also got...
You've got a gas alarm.
Gordon.
So it's basically, it's a shell case.
Artillery shell with metal and pieces of, like, nuts and bolts that they would have found lying around the trenches.
Yeah, I'm not making much of that. Am I doing it wrong?
You just got to give it a really good rattle.
Ah, so it's all the wrist action.
It's all in the wrist.
You know, so basically, you hear that straight into the gas mask.
Yeah, get the gas mask on as quick as you can. You've normally got about 8 seconds before the gas starts to take effect in your lungs.
This is the fire step. It might scare a few dog walkers going past here, but certainly this is the fire step.
Commanding an excellent field of fire over Keppelston Gardens.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That'll learn them.
We've got our own no man's land across the way there too.
Yeah, precisely. Oh, right. Is that a periscope you got down that end?
That's just went in today. We've got a few different styles of periscopes. Ones that children can pick up quite easily with handles. Ones that are built in place.
It works remarkably well, that too.
Yeah, two mirrors at a 45-degree angle, and it just reflects the image over the top. So, yeah, it's complete safety over sticking your head over and getting that chance of getting shot.
This is yet another one of these little dugouts, and you've got an authentic stretcher here.
Yeah, so this is our regimental aid post. So in here we've got lots of little things to do with the medical side, because in the trenches we would have regimental aid posts for the men who were injured from being out over the top. So broken legs, artillery shell wounds, shrapnel that could be dealt with at the front line, and then it would go further back depending on how bad their condition was. But we do have an original stretcher, which is a fantastic piece to have.
And this brings us more or less to the end of it then.
So yeah, so this is our observation post here. So this brings you closer to the enemy's trenches, so you'll be able to see and hear what they were getting up to. So it's kind of like a spying area, and it just gives you that idea. And then we've got the barbed wire and our version of No Man's Land up the top with our rattly tins for anybody that tries to break through our barbed wire.
That does kind of look like authentic period barbed wire, too. That's not recent stuff.
It's actually about, I don't know, what, 4 months old? I made it myself in the car park, as well as the barbed wire
well
pickets
yeah.
are personally made by myself and our maintenance chap, Darren, here at the museum.
And what's that metal shield there?
So this is our original German sniper shield from the First World War.
Okay.
So the way they used to work is they would lie like this up against the wall. You'd have a periscope next to it with a spotter, and then you would slide the door open, rifle through, and then you've got just
take
enough room to look out, and then you've got this perfect curvature, which means any shrapnel, anything bouncing off, goes the other direction and doesn't fly towards you or any of your other men.
Yeah, so even things like machine gun bullets and things like that, at the time...
At the time, we'd be able would have stopped against that. Obviously, the one odd bullet will get through that little hole, and that's that sniper taken out. But that was the aim of the game back in those days. Their steel helmets were never, ever designed to stop a bullet. Yeah. They were there to stop shrapnel. Although bullets wasn't the biggest killer in the First World War, they were still obviously one of the biggest threats, especially with your machine gunners. When you're trying to get over no man's land, you've got the Germans with their machine guns perfectly levelled off at soldiers' legs just to take out the legs. It's quite a scary thought.
I find this absolutely... I mean, you've done this so incredibly well. You know, if you add to this... The mud, the noise, the smell,
absolutely.
The decay.
Yeah.
Hellish. Absolutely hellish.
Absolutely.
It's the closest thing you're going to get to Belgium and France in Aberdeen.
Brian Snelling and Lewis Gibbon of the Gordon Highlanders Museum in Aberdeen. And just a reminder that that Moffat Trench opens on the 5th of February.
Sounds brilliant. It kind of ram home the horrors of war, but every time you hear that... In cold detail, it's just really scary stuff.
Yeah, no, not a nice way of life. Over the last couple of years, we've done quite a few features with wildlife cameraman and Murray Firth Whale and Dolphin Conservation Society field officer Charlie Phillips. Yeah, nice guy, Charlie.
Charlie's great, and he's out most days of the week trying to photograph dolphins for the Whale and Dolphin Conservation Society. But a couple of weeks ago, he had an amazing experience.
He won a watch. He won a watch.
He won the watch. A watch I have coveted for many a long year.
And me.
Anyway, first of all, I asked him to explain just what he does.
My remit really is to try and enthuse people about the natural magic that we have round about us, and really the bottlenose dolphins tend to be the major species that most people
that
come
can't
to
be
see.
Difficult to get people enthused about dolphins.
No. No, you're right there. I mean, my heart beats faster every time I see a dorsal fin, and I know a lot of people share that feeling. We're so blessed in this area to have local dolphins that we see basically 12 months of the year. Although months like January, February can be a little bit quiet. The weather just recently hasn't been that brilliant. Today's lovely, it's cold and crisp. It's an ideal day for actually watching.
Like dolphins, fantastic. But recently you saw something potentially even more impressive.
Yeah, 2019 went off with an absolute wahoo. I was phoned up, 7th of January it was, phoned up by an old pal of mine who was sitting in his car at the car park at Channanry. And he phoned me up saying that he'd spotted two great big dorsal fins. I mean, really huge dorsal fins. So Charlie says, they're far, far bigger than dolphins. So something in the back of my mind just thought, right, okay, I'm going to jump in the car and head around to Channanry and met Francis and had a look at the back of his camera, and he'd managed to get a couple of dorsal fin shots, and I thought, oh, here, this is rather exciting. Orca, or killer whale, as some people call them, and definitely two of them. I stayed on for a while, and it was blowing a gale. It was an absolute howler. Even getting out the car was really tricky. And I sat for about an hour, and I eventually caught a way out in the big surfy waves out between the Channanry car park and Inverness Airport shoreline. Caught this big, you know, 6 foot dorsal fin coming to the surface, and a great big blow of breath. And it was immediately recognisable. It was definitely an orca, and it wasn't just any old orca. It was actually one of the most famous orca on the planet. He's been so well known, this guy. His name's John Coe. His identity number's WO1. He's one of the west coast of Scotland population.
So, did you seen him before? Whales.
The last time I saw John Coe was about 20 years ago from Ardnamurchan Lighthouse.
How can you be so sure that it was him?
I'm used to looking at dorsal fins of bottlenose dolphins, and you get to know, you know, their subtle differences. But John Coe isn't subtle. He has got a 6-foot-tall dorsal fin that's got a huge chunk missing about 2/3 of the way down from it. Unique. There's no other animal like him.
So why do you think they would be here, or are they common visitors off the coast of Inverness?
The west coast population of orca aren't seen that often over here. They were spotted in 2013 by friends of mine along near Fintorn, North 58, the boat tours, and they saw some members of the west coast population, including John Coe. So it's been about 5 years since he's been here, but I've never seen him over here personally myself, but he was with another big male as well. And thankfully, we have quite a lot of knowledgeable people that we keep in touch with. And one or two of them started hypothesising that John Coe hangs about with another big guy called Aquarius. There's also another big chap in this population that it might have been called Comet. There are only 8 in this population, and the sad thing is that they've never actually had a calf in this population for many, many years.
So would they be looking for females, or were they looking for food?
I think they were in just scouting about for some food, to be quite honest.
Would they interact with dolphins?
Possibly. Possibly. There were herring in the area. We'd had some quite good dolphin sightings. But what we believe that the west coast population of orca actually are marine mammal eaters. So they might have been in looking for seals, which is my theory was that they're probably in looking for either seals or maybe harbour porpoises. I don't think they would take on one of our big adult bottlenose dolphins, because our dolphins are huge.
But there's lots of seals in the
yes, yes, and park. that is a draw. You'll find that where there are seal populations, you will find predators popping up for a wee look now and again. And it has been well known that we get some of the Icelandic orcas coming down round about Shetland, and they sometimes drop down to Orkney and come through the Pentland Firth. They're on the lookout quite often for seals.
And seal populations are thriving, so I would imagine there's a potential for them to come back.
Only certain populations are thriving. Yeah. We've got the actual commoner harbour seal. Their numbers are declining dramatically in some cases. The greys seem to be holding their own. There are some seal populations that seem to be moving about. There are haul-out sites that are becoming almost empty now, but others that are becoming remarkably full. What has caused those animals to move? Is it lack of food in one area and plenty of food in the other, or are our predators actually scaring them along?
Your big killer whale's got a big chunk out the fin, so you can almost imagine how easy it would be. How would you normally identify a killer whale?
Killer whales, a bit like the bottlenose dolphins, they tend to be dorsal fin shape and size, but orca also have an almost light grey, what they call saddle patch, that's behind the dorsal fin, and that's a unique shape to each animal. And that is the diagnostic, that's the absolute 100% diagnostic feature. These are a combination of the dorsal fin itself and the actual saddle patch behind the dorsal fin. Whereas with bottlenose dolphins, we tend to only need to use the actual dorsal fin, because it is so unique and diagnostic.
Must have boosted the number of photo watching dolphins at Channery Point. Or did you keep quiet about it?
Yeah, I had to put up a little bit of something on social media. So one of my pictures that I took of the big dorsal fin of John Coe, I snapped a picture of it off the back of my camera with my phone and stuck it up on Twitter. And then after that, the whole world went to hell in a handbasket and the place was mobbed. For the next 4 or 5 hours, there were quite a lot of people, not only in the Channery car park, but also over at Fort George as well. And quite a few people did actually see these two orca. They headed back out again, but then after I'd left, they actually sneaked back in again. And it was still wild weather. It was still absolutely wild weather, but a lot of people saw them and they were absolutely thrilled. It's for a lot of people, it's a once-in-a-lifetime thing, you know.
Yeah, for a lot of people it is a once-in-a-lifetime thing. For both of us, it's a never-in-a-lifetime thing. We've never seen an orca.
And so many times, I can't remember if it was with you or not, we were up in Orkney, with ex-chief executive of the Scottish Wildlife Trust. And he's got a wee croft right down to the water. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about the attractions of wildlife in Orkney, birds, and of course orca. And he said, yeah, they've come down here, I've seen amazing sights. And I said, okay, great. The next day, we were walking up the high street, and he comes over and says, you guys should have stayed. Half an hour after you left, seven orca came into the box. Why didn't you fall? Honestly, I could have brained them. Lovely man.
If in doubt, thump them.
Although even more interesting, slightly more humorous, a film crew were up there. I wasn't doing this particular story, but they were filming a thing about orca at Dunnet Head. Mm-hmm. And they spent 7 hours looking for orca and chatting about it and eventually gave up. And an hour later, the tweets started coming in. And they'd been playing at the foot of the cliffs.
Oh, no.
Nobody had gone...
And actually looked over the
100 yards and looked over the edge. They were feeding really close at the bottom.
Oh, that's sickening. Absolutely sickening.
Made me laugh.
It would be very funny as long as it wasn't you that was happening to.
Yeah.
And that'll mean, anyway, that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks very much, as I said earlier, for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. We will be back with another one next week. Until then, from all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.